the criminal justice system, sexually based offenses are considered especially heinous. In New York City, the dedicated detectives who investigate these vicious felonies are members of an elite squad known as the Special Victims Unit. These are their stories.
Song from Law & Order Special Victims Unit. Introduced here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to examine important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we want to discuss Law & Order and perhaps also with a certain focus, among other issues, on sex crimes from such special victims. For President Joe Biden has now appointed Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court to fill the seat of retiring Justice Stephen G. Breyer, for whom Jackson actually clerked when she was a law clerk on the Supreme Court a couple of decades ago. And to discuss this important matter, we want to speak with Kurt Levy, who's the president of the Committee for Justice. Well, Kurt, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you for having me on, Andrew.
Well, starting out, who is Ketanji Brown Jackson, and does she have enough experience to serve on the Supreme Court?
Well, I think she has enough experience. She's 51 years old, a graduate of Harvard Law School. She worked on the U.S. Sentencing Commission as a public defender, as a district judge, briefly, most recently, on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. So it's not really a question of experience. She's okay on that measure.
Okay, well, a lot of people have been talking about her as being really radical, like she has a lot of really leftist supporters. Is that true?
Well, it's certainly true that she was the favorite of groups on the left. She was the favorite, you know, when Breyer retired. She was the favorite when Biden first announced that he would pick a black woman. She was the favorite, you know, among groups on the left of the final three on the short list. So she's the darling of groups on the left. And, you know, that tells us something because those are groups that would like to see a progressive living constitution judicial philosophy.
Well, but she said during her confirmation hearings that she was an originalist. What does that mean?
Well, she can call herself an originalist. I believe Elena Kagan in her 2010 hearing said, we're all originalists now. So she's simply acknowledging that the old days where you could just make stuff up are gone. Not that judges still don't make it up, just that they try to hide that they're doing so and, you know, pretend to be originalists. So, you know, things have changed, at least in terms of what judges say they're going to do. But I don't think anyone has a lot of confidence that she's going to be originalist. And believe me, if anybody thought that, the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee would have would have been on her case about it, but they know it's not true.
Well, you mentioned Elena Kagan. I mean, she, for example, in our confirmation hearings, I was just reading over some various articles commenting on the Jackson nomination. You know, she had actually said in her confirmation hearing that there's no right to same-sex marriage in the Constitution, and yet, of course, later in the 5-4 2015 Obergefell decision, she, of course, went along with that. So have originalists won the argument about constitutional law now? Is everyone now saying we're an originalist?
Well, I agree with what Kagan said. We're all originalists now in terms of talking the talk, or at least, what you tell senators at your confirmation hearing. And I guess that's a little bit of a victory. At least people don't try to defend the living constitution philosophy anymore. But, what would be really nice is if judges actually started being originalists.
Yeah, I guess that is indeed then kind of a public relations political battle that's being won. Americans really do want a constant understanding of the Constitution. They don't want just people playing around, and to the extent there should be changes in the Constitution or in our society, that should be something that the American people should vote for through their political representatives.
Yeah, and there are various polls that indicate that people think that judges should be interpreting the law, not making the law.
Well, how does Jackson compare to other Supreme Court justice nominations?
She will probably be, about as liberal / progressive as Sotomayor or Ginsburg. That would be my guess. We won't know for sure until she's on the court, because when you're on the lower court, you are constrained by precedent, and you're not when you're on the Supreme Court. And then, we get to find out what you really think.
Yeah, indeed. Well, a lot of people looking at her lower court opinions, first in the district court and then later on the appeals court for the Washington, D.C. Circuit, an appellate judge there. People have criticized her decisions involving child pornography, although some conservatives like Rich Lowry have suggested that's kind of a demagogic attack, that Jackson's sentencing for individuals convicted of possessing and distributing child pornography were just way too low. What do you think of that issue?
Well, I'm not going to debate whether they're too low or too high or just right. It depends on your philosophy on sentencing and crime. But they certainly were below the averages. If you look at her sentences for crime in general, they tended to be about, more than a third below the average for federal courts. And on child porn cases, they were about 50% below the guidelines. So, I think she's clearly liberal on crime. That's what you'd expect from someone who had been a former public defender. That's what you would expect from someone appointed by this president. That's what you would expect from somebody who is the darling of groups on the left. So, there are going to be libertarians on the right who think that's a good thing, and I'll let the audience judge for itself, but she'll definitely be liberal on crime.
Well, one of the things she mentioned as a sentencing factor in one of her statements, actually, I believe in a speech she gave once, that she believes that critical race theory should be a sentencing factor. What's Jackson's relationship to critical race theory, CRT?
Yeah, I don't think she's actually said that critical race theory should be a factor. I mean, she was giving a talk on sentencing, and she she did mention CRT, but I think it's overstating it to say that she said CRT should be a factor in sentencing. Whether she believes in, critical race theory, that's another question. I don't know. But, let's not overstate it. Given her politics, she probably does believe in critical race theory, and that probably will in some subtle way affect her rulings, but I don't want to overstate the case.
Yeah, I mean, she apparently is on the board of a school, I guess, for her kids, people have criticized it, assigns all these books on critical race theory to the students from, like Ibram Kendi and so forth. How could CRT affect her on the Supreme Court?
A lot of legal issues involve discrimination. Or alleged discrimination, obviously involve, people being shot by the police, rightfully or wrongfully, and those are going to come, those issues come before the court, and, you know, certainly your view on whether the United States is not only systemically racist, but, you know, founded to be racist, which is basically what you know, CRT and the 1619 Project say, you know, of course that's going to affect her ruling on cases that involve race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, people have known, for example, you've got this affirmative action case coming up involving Harvard University, and both Elena Kagan and Jackson went to Harvard, and Jackson is on the board of overseers or such at Harvard University. So that might involve actually these two Supreme Court justices having to recuse themselves in that case.
Well, I don't know about I don't know if Kagan is going to be if I understood you correctly, if Kagan is going to recuse herself, but KBJ said that it's her quote plan to recuse herself. So, you know, more than likely she will, and she certainly should.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a clear, you know,
okay, yeah,
there's
yeah.
A, unlike, you know, the conflicts of interest that they try to gin up concerning Clarence Thomas and his wife. A real conflict of interest, you know, requires that you actually have a connection to one of the parties in the case, and clearly Jackson does have a connection to Harvard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, what about people have raised alarms about numerous issues, I guess. One issue is, how do you think Jackson might affect abortion jurisprudence? I mean, she clerked for Stephen Breyer when he wrote in 2000 the Stenberg v. Carhart decision that people have noted that at the time upheld a partial birth abortion, this really brutal practice of engaging in abortion, even, you know, right at the moment of birth, that was later overruled in 2007 by Gonzalez v. Carhart. How might she affect issues involving abortion on the Supreme Court?
I don't think there's much doubt that she's going to side with the liberals on the court when it comes to abortion. She, of course, the big abortion case that's going to be decided in the next few months, Dobbs, she won't have any say in, but there'll surely be further abortion cases. She was given an opportunity to sort of renounce or at least be critical of substantive due process, which is the, you know, made-up constitutional theory under which both Roe and Casey created a right to abortion. And, you know, she did not do that. That gives you even more indication. But, you know, I don't think there really is much doubt. She is a progressive. And, but, you know, again, Breyer was 100% behind abortion as well. So, I don't think it's going to make a big difference whether it's Breyer or Jackson, frankly.
Yeah,
you know,
I guess
where
maybe
we'll have to worry about her is, you know, as time goes on and, you know, there's no longer, you know, five or, if you want to count Robert, six conservatives on the court.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I guess it's kind of a wash there. And again, you would expect such a kind of a litmus test, a standard from Democrats like Joe Biden to appoint a person that's sort of like the holy grail, you know, the sacred, the most sacred of issues for Democrats on the Supreme Court. So I guess there would be no change there. You would indeed expect, as it were, kind of an absolutist. Well, thinking of that issue, how might Jackson rule on issues involving religious liberty or free speech? I mean, involving abortion, for example, there's been some question that she once in the decision upheld or she proposed a sort of exclusion zones around abortion clinics for all of these, you know, various sidewalk counselors and opponents of abortion, that speech should be restricted in front of an abortion clinic.
Well, the current state of the law is that, you know, you can have some sort of buffer zone, and I don't frankly remember the details of her case, but, you know, it is Supreme Court precedent that a reasonably small buffer zone is permissible, that you're not violating anyone's First Amendment rights.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so perhaps not much. Well, what about free speech in general? I guess we've got a lot of issues coming up involving like big tech and, you know, how they've gone so woke and so forth. How might Jackson figure in there in any questions?
hard to know. She, you know, doesn't have a record, much of a record when it comes to free speech issues. Again, I think she's going to be reliably progressive, and certainly progressives are united in wanting to regulate big tech more. It's really on the right where you have the split, where you have, you know, some conservatives who are so angry at big tech that they want to regulate it or break it up, and then you have, say, more libertarian types of conservatives who think that, you know, government is not more government is not the solution. I should also point out, to be fair, that the big tech companies, as aggravating as they can be, are not state actors, and therefore are not capable of violating the First Amendment. The First Amendment applies only to the government and other related state actors.
Right. Yeah, well, okay. Well, there's also been criticism of Jackson's positions on sort of border security and also national security issues. I mean, she had this one case where she was later overruled by the appellate court where she struck down a law that gave the Department of Homeland Security the sole capability of reviewing or having the sole power to deport illegal aliens here, and she, you know, was assigned that in the very language of the statute, but she overruled that. How will Jackson figure on such cases like that?
You know, I take that less as being an indication of how she feels about immigration, although, again, being a progressive, I think we can guess, and more about that she really did not like President Trump and his administration. You know, if you're looking for evidence of activism, that's where it really shows up. There were a number of cases where she really went out of her way to rule against regulations or executive orders of the Trump administration. And again, if one is going to guess, progressives are pretty united at this point in time on you know, having something pretty close to open borders. So I certainly wouldn't look to her to uphold any restrictions on immigration.
Yeah, and she had also been a defense lawyer for various inmates at Guantanamo Bay, so some people have raised questions there. But what were some of the other cases then where she overturned Trump's decisions or policies?
Well, you know, most recently, you know, one involving the Labor Department and what, you know, issues had to be bargained over and which didn't. You know, it's a potpourri, but again, things like that where it's either regulations or executive orders of the Trump administration.
Well, there's one controversy. Has the White House withheld the White House has withheld documents concerning Jackson's time, as you say, on the United States Sentencing Commission? Is that something we should be concerned about? I've heard that an estimate there's something like 48,000 pages that have been withheld by the White House concerning her service there.
Yeah, I think that is a legitimate concern, especially since her sentencing practices, you know, are a controversial issue. As a general rule, you know, it's one thing to say that, you know, there was some question of asking that, you know, sentencing reports on individual defendants when she was on the district court be released, and there really are confidentiality issues. But, you know, what she said when she was on the Sentencing Commission, which makes policy, really should be open to public scrutiny, and the fact that they didn't want to release that, you know, makes you wonder if there's something that they're hiding. And, you know, there probably is, because she has said things over the years that, you know, especially when it comes to child pornography, that she believes the sentencing guidelines are overly harsh, especially as now applied to an electronic age in which, you know, having 300 images, you know, meant you were a pretty serious child pornographer, you know, back in the day, but now just might mean you, you know, you downloaded one zip file. So I get her point, but still it's disturbing that, you know, they won't release it. And again, it's almost surely because she has said, you know, a variety of things indicating that we need more lenient sentences for child pornographers. And again, like I said, you know, we can debate that. There'll be libertarians, you know, on the right who agree with her. But so the disturbing part, to me at least, is not what the sentences were that she gave when she was a district court, but what her views are generally and why the administration will not release those records.
Well, that brings up an interesting question. What are the powers concerning releasing the records in such a nomination fight like this? I guess so the White House in this case has its executive privilege. It can decide whether or not to release such documents, or is there any possibility for, like, the Senate suing to get those documents?
No, there's no chance of the Senate suing to get them. It really is up to the administration. And you know what? Even if there was a legal avenue, which there's not, you know, these nominations move so quickly that there wouldn't be time for it to play out in court. She's going to very likely, you know, be confirmed within the next 10 days.
You know, I guess it's...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Where Jackson was asked by Senator Marsha Blackburn to define a woman. How will that affect her position on the Supreme Court, where, you know, she seems to be going along with this whole transgender ideology?
Again, you know, no surprises there. Again, she was the favorite of groups on the left for a reason. Favorite of this president for a reason. There's no question that she's going to be woke on a variety of issues, and I suspect that transgender rights are one of those issues. I would hope that, you know, we wouldn't actually see her say an opinion, you know, rule one way or the other, because you can't define a woman. You know, she was just trying not to answer the question because she knows that, you know, in Wokeville, it's not acceptable to, you know, give a biological definition of whether you're a man or a woman. So she was being, depending on your viewpoint, being cautious or evasive there. I suspect she knows how to define a woman and will not claim to, you know, not know in any opinions she writes.
Well, I guess looking to this broader nomination fight here, what do you think about this whole idea of Jackson fulfilling President Joe Biden's promise to appoint a black woman to the Supreme Court? You know, what does that say about identity politics in the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was disturbing, you know, not because it's not a good thing to have a black woman on the Supreme Court, not because black women are any more or less capable than any other demographic group, but because you're limiting yourself to a few percent of the legal profession when you say that. And, you know, he could have even said, you know, I'm going to appoint a minority or a minority woman. You know, there's never been an Asian on the court. There's never been somebody from the Indian subcontinent. There's never been a Native American. There's never been a male Hispanic. There's never been someone openly gay. There's never been someone disabled. You know, there are a lot of, if you're looking for, you know, identity group type diversity, which of course is, in my view, you know, only one of many types of diversity, then, you know, then why limit it to black women? So I think that was, you know, not only overly restrictive, but, you know, I think goes against the spirit of the Equal Protection Clause. And, you know, it was clearly due to politics. I mean, he first made that promise when he needed to win the South Carolina primary. And that is a heavily black state, and he was trying to appeal to black interest group. And, you know, that's okay. That's politics. President can pick whoever he wants for the courts. But, you know, let's not pretend it's something, you know, it's something that was done to advance civil rights. It was done for political reasons.
Yeah, I mean, Ilya Shapiro, who had been appointed this adjunct professorship at Georgetown University, a scholar at the Cato Institute, you know, he had tweeted out in this controversial tweet that sort of misinterpreted, you know, he talked about people being passed over for a lesser black woman. And he also mentioned the idea that, you know, there's some Indian American person he mentioned that, you know, Biden could have appointed, which would have been, you know, maybe an excellent choice. So as you indicate, you know, no one from the South Asia has yet served on the Supreme Court. So, yeah, there's a limiting issue there of putting someone's ethnicity over qualifications. Well, could someone like Biden or
To say that if you really were looking for diversity, he could have picked from the short list Michelle Childs, a judge in South Carolina who went to, you know, had a more modest educational background than did Jackson, who went to Harvard undergrad and for law school. And, you know, even though I was a classmate of hers, I think it's ridiculous that you know, all Supreme Court justices virtually have to come from Harvard and Yale. So, you know, one of the problems with this focus on racial diversity is that I think it sort of blinds us to the fact that, you know, skin color may only go so deep, that, you know, real diversity would involve people with, you know, very different backgrounds, including not going to the top schools in the nation. Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, I guess in closing out here, what do you think will be the political implications of this nomination? Should conservatives really emphasize Jackson in coming elections like the 2024 presidential election?
Well, you know, we're a long way from that. You know, so perhaps the more relevant question is whether it'll play a role in the 2022 midterm elections. I think the Democrats are, you know, hoping that it will. It's still 7 months before the election, and she's, you know, like I said, likely to be confirmed in the next 10 days. So I don't know that it's going to increase turnout among African Americans as Democrats hope. You know, I think that Republicans took a strategy that's similar to what Democrats did with Barrett. They knew they couldn't stop Barrett, so they tried to make other points, such as about Obamacare. And, you know, I think, you know, probably were somewhat successful in that approach. And Republicans tried to make other points with Jackson, who they're not going to be able to stop, involving crime. And crime is very much on the minds of voters. And I guess we'll see November, whether that works to Republicans' favor. You know, whether this will have an impact on the court in 2024, you know, hard to know. I think, you know, by then she'll probably be viewed as just another liberal on the court, not all that differently from the other liberals on the court.
Well, thinking of politics again, how would this nomination affect certain Democrats? Like a lot of eyes are on Democratic Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia. Could he suffer any consequences in a conservative state like that by supporting Jackson?
Yeah, he might. I don't know that he will. And certainly on judicial nominations, you know, he has tended to be a loyal Democrat. I mean, sometimes he'll, you know, vote with the Republicans when it doesn't matter, but certainly when it matters, he's voted with Democrats as a loyal Democrat on judicial nominations. But, you know, I guess it somewhat depends. I mean, right now, I wouldn't say voting for her is radioactive, but, you know, let's see what she says and does once she's on the Supreme Court. It may come back to bite him in his home state, which has, you know, become very conservative.
All right, then. Excellent. Well, for our listeners out here, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Arad, where we like to examine important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we've been talking to Kurt Levy, the president of the Committee for Justice, about President Joe Biden's recent Supreme Court nominee, Ketanji Brown Jackson. Well, Kurt, thank you for joining the show.
Andrew, thank you very much for having me on.
All right, and for our listeners out there,